and this is Studio 2 from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolf-Manera.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. It's November 6th. Donald Trump will be the next president of the United States after breaking through the blue wall states of Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. He delivered an acceptance speech from West Palm Beach, Florida, early this morning. You heard a clip earlier. Now take a listen.
This will truly be the golden age of America. That's what we have to have. Many people have told me that God spared my life for a reason. And that reason was to save our country and to restore America to greatness. And so I want to just tell you what a great honor this is. I want to thank you. I will not let you down. America's future will be bigger, better, bolder, richer, safer, and stronger than it has ever been before. God bless you and God bless America. Thank you very much.
Down ballot results in the Commonwealth from U.S. House seats to the AG race also mostly broke for Republicans. The U.S. Senate race between Casey and McCormick, right now it is still too close to call.
And today we're going to dive right into the results, the data, and the turnout. And I'll be honest with everyone listening right now, you know, I usually come with my big set of questions. Today, just a few bullet points. I want this to be a conversation as we all figure out what exactly happened yesterday, what exactly happened last night, and why. So joining us in studio, we have Terry Tracy, CEO and author at Broad and Liberty. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thank you.
We also have Anthea Butler, Geraldine R. Siegel Professor in American Social Thought and Chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome back to the program as well.
Thank you.
And a first-timer here, Dan Hopkins, Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Dan, welcome into Studio 2.
Thank you.
Yeah, and we want to hear from you. How do you explain the election results? How are you feeling about the results? You can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
And look, we have a sense of what happened. I think the big question is why. There are so many potential explanations for why the entire electorate shifted rightward. I'll start with you, Terry Tracy. Last time you were on the program, you were talking about maintaining the filibuster. I imagine that's a much more popular position with our listeners today than it was yesterday.
Yeah.
Terry Tracy, why do you think we saw the results we saw last night?
Yeah, I thought they might see where I was coming from in the event this happened and with the potentiality of unified government. I think, you know, there are a number of issues to unpack. In the beginning of the show, you listed them: the economic issues, the cultural issues, concerns about the institutional strength of American democracy. But I think if you were to just sort of step back and put this in some kind of historical context, to the extent that's even possible less than 24 hours out, I think what happened yesterday was the culmination of a political realignment that's been occurring for the better part of, you know, two decades. The Republican Party is now a multiracial, multi-ethnic, populist working class party. That's what it's dominated by. And it's led by a populist billionaire, however contradictions you know, may exist there. That is the reality of the coalition that came out of yesterday's results. And, you know, it's interesting because this is the first time that the Republican Party has had a sort of coherent governing coalition that can produce these kinds of electoral outcomes since Ronald Reagan. Really.
Right. In high turnout elections.
In high turnout elections, exactly. For the first time in my professional career in the policy space or political space, it was the first time where the idea of high turnout was to the benefit of Republicans.
Yep.
And I will tell you anecdotally that the grassroots energy that I saw amongst the Republican base, volunteerism, you know, signs going out of county offices, small donations, was sort of akin to what it felt like on the during the early Obama years in 2008.
Hmm.
This is really a political movement. There's lots to debate about the efficacy of the policies and the future of the country, but in a purely political construct, you know, the Republican Party has finally found coherence ideologically, and a governing coalition that can win elections in big states in a way that it hasn't been able to do in some time.
Anthea Butler, why?
Why not? I mean, you know, I'm asking myself a lot of questions this morning, but I think I'm focused on a couple of things that are very interesting. I think the realignment question and what you brought up, Terry, is really important because it has been a realignment. But because I talk about religion, I need to throw religion into that mix because I think that's really important. And part of that realignment has been about Democrats thinking that, you know, maybe this wasn't an important thing to talk about, or we're going to talk about it in this one kind of flat way. Mm. But the energy on the side of Republicans and the energy that has been on the side of religious leadership, and I mean specifically here, not just evangelicals, but a whole slew of people, Pentecostals and others, who make up that broad base of the sort of ethnic makeup that you talk about, that this is a populist thing, that is what has energized this and changed it. So I was just looking at the chart that everybody's been passing around this morning. White men for Trump, 57%. White women, 51%. But what's the next category? Latino men, 45%. Latino women, 36%. Yep. Mm-hmm. That is what undergirded this. And I'll tell anecdotally, one of my former students is down in Florida, specifically Miami. And she said, you know, I can't go to sleep tonight for hearing the horns honking for Trump.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that, to me, says something. So what I'm going to be really interested in as we sort of dissect all of this is how is this, you know, religious piece and the cultural piece of this sort of multi-ethnic new Republican Party with three houses looks like, right? Mm-hmm. And that's going to change a lot of things, and I think people may not be ready for how that's going to change, and I think that's going to be an important question as we go forward.
To your point about Latino voters, This is data from Hazleton, Pennsylvania, a city that is 62% Latino. This is from Steve Kornacki. We all know Steve Kornacki,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
2016, that was a D+5 city. In 2024, it was an R+25
city.
So let's keep on this why question. Let's finish out going around the table here. Dan Hopkins, how do you explain what happened?
From the point of view of studying voter behavior, yesterday was a pretty normal election, right? Mm. And I'm not saying that the election was normal, but I'm saying that if you told me several years ago that a Republican would run against a Democrat at a time of like meaningful inflation when the incumbent Democrat's approval was about 40% and, you know, perceptions of the economy were mixed but on balance negative, yeah, I would have told you that a narrow Republican popular vote win wasn't that surprising. And we saw that last night was largely a nationalized election where the swing towards the Republicans took place in suburban, you know,
everywhere.
Almost across the board.
Yeah.
Exactly. There are a few, you can point to occasional, generally pretty small counties, but it took place
Shout
here.
Out Atlanta metro area,
yeah.
I guess. But other than that, yeah, it all swung right.
Yeah. And I think that speaks to our highly, highly nationalized politics. And so I would say that the, you know, I think as Terry and Anthea have rightly pointed out, the American electorate is incredibly diverse, right? And it's growing more diverse. I though tend to think of elections more as snapshots. You know, I remember after the 2004 election that we were celebrating a new emerging Republican majority that only lasted until 2006. And in fact, if you think back, what was the last federal election in which at least one, either the presidency, the House, or the Senate didn't change hands, right? It was – do we have to think back to about 2004? So that's 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so much as we are tempted to be struck by last night's genuinely remarkable result
Swings are not remarkable. Swings happen all the time.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. And this is – you know, the idea that Pennsylvania, which – you know, we had a Republican governor here from 2010 to 2014. Our legislature has frequently been Republican dominated. You know, Tom Ridge, Senator Toomey, like Republicans can win this state.
Yeah.
And so the fact that they've done so again, I think, is not that surprising.
Yeah. I want to bring in a caller. By the way, if you want to join our conversation, you can call in now, 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whry.org. I want to bring in Chris from Delaware County. Chris, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is that I have lost all faith in people and humanity that they could vote for this man to be the leader of the free world. And it has nothing to do with being a Republican or a Democrat. Because, yes, things swing both ways. But we all know what this man is like and what he thinks and what he's going to do. And the fact that so many people in our country voted for him to lead us is, I have never been more upset in my life. Yeah. And I just hope to God that we can survive the 4 years and that he will leave, or that we can remove him at the end of those 4 years.
Yeah. Thank you so much. That's Chris from Delaware County. And a lot of people are feeling like this today, so we want to acknowledge that feeling. But that brings up my question for you is this really a Trump phenomenon? And you guys talked about the shifting, you know, political divide now. It seems to be working class on one side, and we show that Harris won overwhelmingly, you know, when it comes to college-educated folks. And we've seen this shift. Can you talk about this? Is this sort of a trend that you believe will continue even post-Trump? And you talked about things have shifted in the Republican Party. How permanent is this? And Dan, yeah.
It's a good question. And I would say just to Chris that I very much hear your emotion, and you're certainly not the only person mm-hmm. to be expressing it. And I think one thing that I would emphasize is that I, in my role as a political scientist, have the opportunity to talk to many, many Americans through exit polling, through surveys. And one of the things that I think is important to keep in mind is that the incredible diversity mm-hmm. of this country gets reduced to a choice of one party yeah. or the other. Yeah. And so people vote for candidates for lots of different reasons. And I would say that in my own survey work, a significant majority, about two-thirds of Americans, believe, say, that the 2020 election was won by Joe Biden. And so I would I know that there are many, many voters, millions of voters, mm-hmm. who will not get over, say, January 6th. But I also know that there are millions of people who voted for Donald Trump for reasons related to the economy, mm-hmm. for reasons related to immigration and the southern border. And I also know that just because a country is closely divided between two sides doesn't necessarily mean that it's deeply divided. And that while there are certainly plenty of activists who are party line activists on either side, there are also millions and millions of Americans who hold views that you wouldn't expect. Yeah. And so I very, very much understand the emotion, but I would say both that power has been very conditional, that the American public has granted power to each party in the last set of elections and then very quickly taken it back, right? Yeah. How quickly did we go from Barack Obama's mm-hmm. landmark victory in 2008 to the Republicans retaking the House of Representatives with a sweeping shift of, I think, 63 yeah. House seats in the yeah. 2010 election?
Yeah, and my question for you, Anthea, is to sort of like expand on that, the permanence of it. And I'll say this, and Avi and I were talking about this earlier. Mm-hmm. I've seen a shift even in my family members. Mm-hmm. I had a number of family members who felt like the Democratic Party just did not see them. Yeah. And they were very attracted to Donald Trump. They were very attracted to issues. They wanted a better economy. They wanted more opportunity. And they felt that Trump offered that. And the Republican Party offered that. I want you mm-hmm. to talk about this. Is this a uniquely Trump thing, or is this a shift in the Republican Party?
I think it's both. I think that, let's talk about the uniquely Trump thing first. I think the brilliant thing that Donald Trump does, and everybody's going to be mad at me because I said brilliant. You know, I think the brilliant thing that he's done is that he has been able to position himself as a rich man who speaks for the poor man.
Yeah.
Okay. And so if you're the rich man who speaks for the poor man, or you.
How does he do that? Voice, do you think?
Yeah. I think he does it because he speaks in a language that they understand. He doesn't like put his sentences together. He does this kind of thing where he makes it like you. It's all WWF.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. it's a way in which
you think
you
it
behave.
Helps that people perceive that the establishment hates him?
Yes. Absolutely. Because they feel like he's on their side.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, you can't. I want to say this in the most gentle way possible, even though it's not going to be gentle. Malevolence makes people feel good sometimes. Mm-hmm. And this idea that you can, you know, lord it over and beat up folks and not like them and get your enemy back and all of this talk that he's done, I think for a lot of people, they've internalized that as he's going to help me get back at everything,
yeah,
at what all these people have
people
done to me,
angry at the
people
system.
Who've made me angry or whatever,
yeah,
you know. And to the point about African Americans, I think, you know, it was all the barbershop thing and everything else. And see, this the thing of this election cycle is not going to be about black men; it's going to be about Latino men. Okay,
yeah,
so let me
yeah,
just
yeah.
put that right there.
Or men in general.
Men in general. This
men
is a whole
general.
Gender. This
yeah.
is a whole gender election, basically. I think, you know, that's the other part.
We're coming up on a break real quick, but finish
yeah.
that point.
I think that, you know, what people have to understand is, I think one of the things that bothered me at the beginning of Kamala Harris's campaign was that she talked a lot about the middle class, and I'm like, what about everybody else?
Mm. Yeah. Okay, let's hold that thought, because I want to get into the other side of this break. Was this result about context and basic underlying conditions, or was it about the campaigns themselves mm-hmm. and the way the candidates express themselves? So if you have thoughts on that, 888-477-9499, Studio 2 at WHYY.org. This is Studio 2, and we'll be right back.
I'm happy with the results. We need to go the opposite way that we've been going for the last 4 years. Close the border, get back to the normal, what it was before Biden got in, and we'll take it from there.
I'm feeling good. It's like Christmas Day for us. Because hopefully, you know, I get my savings back. I don't have to work my 2.5 jobs I work.
You know when you just can't believe what you're seeing? That's what it felt like.
Very shocking to see the red wave across the country.
I feel a little out of the loop. Like, who we surround ourselves with, we think we're on a path, and then we see, you know, Pennsylvania go so red like that is really just shocking.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Welcome back to this special post-election day coverage. Some great perspectives there mm-hmm. from voters across our region this morning. You just heard from Tom in Langhorne, Joni in Bensalem, Emily in Delco, and Ayana in Mount Airy.
And I want to reintroduce our three guests that are joining us in studio to help us sort through this. We have Terry Tracy, CEO and an author at Broad and Liberty. We have Anthea Butler, a professor in American social thought and chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and Dan Hopkins, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania.
Join the conversation, folks. Studio 2 at WHYY.org or call 888-477-9499. And let's go to line two now. Al from North Philly, and I think we've had Al on the program before, mm-hmm. if I recall
Welcome
correctly.
Back.
Al, you're on Studio 2. What's your take on yesterday?
I love your program. I thought that Kamala ran a brilliant race. She is so impressive, but she needed to do one more thing, and that is answer the incredible lies of that ran in a loop all day, all night about her role as a prosecutor, where they painted her as a latter-day Dukakis letting Willie Horton out to murder people. All she had to do was create ads that were just as visceral but told the truth about her role as a prosecutor, where we would have seen the victims that she protected and their families get on TV and tell us, oh, thank you, she saved us, thank you, she believed in us, thank you, she fought for us. And that would have really been visceral and answered the visceral lies of the other side and made women in Chester County and Montgomery County suddenly say, you know what, we can trust her.
Yeah. Interesting.
She never did that.
Thank you, Al. It's Al in North Philly.
Yeah.
And let me broaden that a little bit for you, Terry Tracy, because I think you can make a very convincing argument that this was an underperformance by the Harris campaign, or that she overperformed given the inflationary conditions and the fact that incumbent parties around the world have been getting routed left, right, and center. Where do you come down there?
And she only had 3 months to do it.
And 105 days.
Sort of so, analysis of her campaign and her efforts here.
The Overton window is responsive to conditions on the ground.
Yeah.
But campaigns and candidates are the catalysts for change ultimately on the policy front and on the electoral front. And I think that, you know, the Democrats put themselves in a really difficult position just purely as a political matter by being way too slow to acknowledge the fact that President Biden was not capable of fulfilling a second term, by allowing him to get on that debate stage on June the 27th and show his cognitive impairment at the and I'm not saying that's every day and every hour, but that is unsettling to the entire nation.
Sure.
And then not establishing a clear process by which they were he was going to step down and he was going to be replaced. And so, you know, that set the Harris campaign back.
Starting from behind.
From behind. And then you have all the conditions you just talked about. I mean, one of the exit polls that struck me the most, or the language in the exit polls that struck me the most, was that 62% of folks nationally said they were poorer than they were four years ago. Mm. Not that they were struggling or the country was on the wrong track, but the word of that or the use of that word poor really struck me. And when you see every county in the Commonwealth moved by 4 or 5 points, Bucks County went red in a presidential year for the first time since the since George H.W. Bush in 1988. Center County, where Penn State University was. When I saw that trending red last night around 11 o'clock, I knew that
it was over.
It was going to be over. Yeah. New York City, he picked up by 20 points. You mentioned in the lead in the show his surprising performance in New Jersey.
Yeah.
What he did was he used the shift in the Overton window based both because of the failures, frankly, of the Biden administration and the issues that resonated most with the electorate, and he played in all 50 states. He was not playing a reductive strategy of, you know, let me get to 270. He was competing in every state. He was competing in big urban areas. He was competing nationally. And strategically, what that did was allowed him to effectively broaden the base for the Republican Party at a time in which it was ripe to do so. And I'm not sure that there was another candidate out there on the Republican side that could have necessarily capitalized on that opportunity the way that he did.
Or was there a Democrat who could have countered it, theoretically?
Right. And potentially. The problem was that Democratic voters were never given the opportunity to vet that.
Mm-hmm. And that was my thought there. And I mean, because I wonder, Anthea, is there anything that she could have done? Because, you know, Al says, you know, kind of is mad at Harris right now. But is there any thing that Democrats could have done better under the circumstances that were presented to them to counter what this moving train that Trump represented?
Not in 105 days.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, Terry, you're right. I was counting off when he was talking. I'm like, do you realize how much time she had? And that's number one. Number two is, you know, I don't know how this will get measured because I think that you can't do an exit poll on people who didn't show up. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the next thing I'm going to say is going to be the big thing, and that is how many people were disaffected with the Democratic Party because of Israel and Gaza. Mm-hmm. How many people? I mean, this was a conversation that I had with a lot of young people and a lot of former students, and you know, for a lot of people, this was the reason why they're like, I can't deal with her. So the question is, did they vote for Trump or did they not vote at all? You know, because that's the X factor we don't know. Okay?
Yoshi from Princeton, New Jersey, by the way, agrees with you on that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So I'm not sure about that. But and then the other thing I think is really important that we haven't really discussed is how did he mobilize young men? And I think that is also a big thing, not just Latino men, but young men who feel disaffected, who resonated with the things that he said, who, you know, are basically maybe broke, right? Because they might not have a job or whatever. Somebody anecdotally said on Twitter that, you know, these men were very upset because they weren't getting dates. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is when you feel that everything is against you, you might go for the person who is airing your grievances out. And we've had grievances, you know, as part of the political campaign since 2008 and Sarah Palin and John McCain. Palin was great about grievance, right? But now, you know, Trump has taken grievance to an art form. And made that grievance resonate with everybody who is for him and who might, you know, be sitting in Bucks County in a really nice house, but feeling like, yeah, I feel like I'm out of this too. I need to vote for him.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Anthea, you mentioned that malevolence is a powerful force mm-hmm. in politics, and so is condescension.
Yes.
You know, and when you had former President Obama out there sort of wagging his finger at folks about how they ought to be voting,
yeah.
the garbage comment mm-hmm. by President Biden, whatever the context was, was awfully stupid. Let's just call it what it was. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken tweeting about $150 billion in aid to Lebanon on the day that North Carolina was basically under the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah, that was bad.
And then you go back to the deplorable stuff and the, you know, clinging to guns and God mm-hmm. and religion. And it starts to manifest itself over time. Mm-hmm. And that particular population you're talking about starts to feel a certain way about how
the
status quo
about that,
views them. Sure.
And I'll redirect this actually over to Dan Hopkins, because I do get that sense that people feel condescended to mm-hmm. by the Democratic mm-hmm. Party. On the other hand, I look at results last night on ballot measures, and I see voters in very Republican states voting for abortion rights, voting for minimum wage in Alaska, raising the minimum wage. Dan Hopkins, it does seem to me that some of the policy positions of the Democrats remain popular even as the Democratic brand seems to be suffering. Am I wrong there, or what do you make of all that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think in some ways on these kinds of issues, I do respectfully disagree a little bit with my co-panelists just in that I think there's a tendency for those of us who watch politics closely to think that the most recent thing the candidate said is kind of the most impactful. But when I look at this from a 35,000-foot perspective, the Democratic vice president was running a short campaign after with a president who has 40% approval, and there are legitimate questions about whether he's up to do this job, let alone to run again. And Kamala Harris, if you look at swing states, the swing states shifted less to the right.
That's a great point.
Than did either the red states or the blue states.
New Jersey versus Pennsylvania, a perfect example of that. New Jersey, a far right swing. Pennsylvania, a right swing, but a less dramatic one.
Yeah, just much more modest. And so getting back to Al's question about is there something Kamala Harris could have done differently in her ads, I think her ads were working. I mean, we saw a lot of those ads. We saw a lot of ads from McCormick and everybody, but and I will not be disappointed to not see those ads constantly. but I do think that the mobilization in the swing states helped stem the losses. And I also would think that – now here I'm going to get accused as a Penn professor of grading on a curve. But I think if you said to Democrats in July that a new nominee is not going to win the presidency – but is going to put the Democrats in a position to win the Michigan Senate seat and to win the Wisconsin Senate seat and maybe just maybe to win the Nevada Senate seat and to make a House race where
– in Arizona, by the way.
Yeah.
Yes, in Arizona indeed too. I mean, that's not the headliner, and I think
– they would have taken that deal is what you're saying.
I think they would have taken that
deal. And that may have been the deal that they took. They just didn't want to say it out loud, right?
Yeah, but it doesn't help them anyway, right? Because they're not in power in the Senate.
Yeah. Oh, but the way Senate cycles work, like Senate
I know what you're talking about. But
yeah, down the road.
Down the road.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but this is the point. Down the road, people can't see that right now. They are looking at what the picture is going to be on January 20th, 2025.
But even so, I think that whether the 50th vote in the United States Senate is Susan Collins or whether the 50th vote in the United States Senate is Dave McCormick is going to have a real impact on Medicaid. And this just very briefly getting back to Avi's great question, one of the challenges is that large-scale social spending doesn't buy votes in the way that it might have used to, right? Mm-hmm. Joe Biden opened the floodgates of federal spending, and it did not net a lot of votes.
May I touch on that briefly? Because I think it goes back to the point that you just made about swing states not moving as far to the right as some of these hardcore, blue states or what have you. Nicholas Kristof wrote a fascinating column earlier in the summer where he talked about, and he sort of contextualized it in terms of progressivism on the West Coast versus Northeastern progressivism. Mm-hmm. And the argument that he was making was basically that, progressive governance on its whole can be very popular and effective, but when it's unchecked, it's problematic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so he said, where there is effectively no opposition to progressive governance on the West Coast states, progressivism has gone too far, and it allows critics of progressivism –
generates backlash.
To make it – but whereas in the Northeastern states, you tend to have more competitive Republican parties. So when you start to break that argument down and you look at New York and you look at New Jersey where the Republicans are deep in minorities in the state legislators and there's Democratic governors and they feel like progressive governance is unchecked, you had a harder swing to the right. In swing states where they are – because they are swing states, they are naturally divided government and you have Democratic governors working with Republican senates or vice versa, you have more of a mix. And I think it speaks to maybe there's some rational governance outcome that can be derived from this, that divided government works. The checks – the system is working. And those shifts that you're seeing are responsive to results and voter preferences ultimately.
Yeah. So many questions have popped up into my mind. I want to get another caller in here. We have Mary from Montgomery County on the line. Mary, what's your comment? How are you feeling about the election results?
Well, I wanted to say that I voted against Harris, not necessarily for Trump. It seemed to me that Harris's policies seem rather socialist, and I didn't think we needed any more social programs than we already have.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. That's Mary from Montgomery County. And Terry, I think that goes kind of to what you're saying, is that, you know, folks were feeling a bit of a backlash against progressives. And so I want to talk about that a little bit, because is the country just not as, you know, forward thinking, not as progressive as people had hoped? Is the country really, I guess, more middle of the road? It seems like that is what this country is, Anthea.
I don't know if I'd call it middle of the road. I would say in flux. And the reason why I say that is because I think there are certain things that people want, but that they also don't want to feel as though somebody else is getting something, right? Mm-hmm. And so part of that, you know, is about, are these progressives, did everybody get something that they didn't want? I still don't think we've dealt with the ramifications of what happened during COVID, right? I started thinking about this because I think one of the reasons why people were more attracted to Trump is because he wanted to power his way through that. And when you power your way through something, it's like, we're going to be on the other side, we're going to be bigger, we're better, but you don't deal with the outgrowth. And, you know, honestly, one of the things we have to say about Biden is that more people died of COVID, yeah, under Biden than they actually did under Trump, right? So that's one piece. The other piece is that this idea that people are not feeling as wealthy, or they don't have enough money, and all of this, that the inflation and all of this, my eggs cost too much, my orange juice costs too much, I can't get the cup of coffee that I might want to get anymore. I think they believe that, you know, this would be a better thing for me if I vote for him, because he said we're going to bring back prosperity and we're going to make sure people have things. And then the second part of that is that, why didn't I have that under Biden? And what is Kamala Harris promising me, right? And so when you have to articulate how people can take care of their everyday, the last thing I'll say is this, and I realize that, you know, everybody else has got numbers and I'm talking about feelings, but I want to really talk about feelings, because I think feelings are important when you go into a general election like this. I think one of the feelings is that people are in it for themselves. This is not about a collective anymore. This is not about, you know, some shared national vision.
What can you do for me?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's an election about, what is this person going to do for me or my family or my loved ones? How will I fare? And is somebody else going to do this? And I don't want to use this one thing as an example. On MSNBC, they had a whole thing where they came and talked to people here in Philadelphia, right? Mm-hmm. And there was this one kid from Guatemala. And, you know, of course he came here in a different, you know, kind of immigrated, right? But he said, I'm tired of these people coming over the border. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see them coming over the border anymore. We need to close the border. And so I sat there thinking, but you got here in a kind of a similar way, but you don't want anybody else to come through. So it's that idea about, I need to think about myself in the midst of this. These other people are going to take something from me.
Hasn't that happened with other immigrant groups, though?
Absolutely.
As they assimilate, they sort of have that idea of pulling up the ladder behind
them.
This is history.
Yeah. This is the history of this city.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think that's a really important point. And I think that, you know, when we – maybe after we look at all of this polling data and everything else, I think immigration is also going to be a big part of this, and what happened and how people feel about immigration and who they think should be here and who should not be here.
Yeah, and that cuts across racial lines.
Yeah.
That cuts across ethnic lines. Uh-huh. We have only a few more minutes before we go to break. You want to bring in another caller here?
Yeah, real quick. Time? We can bring in Jordan from Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Jordan, I think you're going to take us to the break. What is your reaction to yesterday's results?
I totally agree with, I can't remember who it was that just spoke, but I think that we underestimate the average voter in America. I think that we think that they're well-informed, and I think that's a mistake. You know, I think that they do care about themselves, the individual, first and foremost, and secondary, the collective, you know. And I also think that misogyny and race is very much embedded in our country still. I think that this is a great example. You know, Hillary Clinton, a white woman whose husband was a president, she ran, she lost. And again, you know, here we are. It feels like Groundhog's Day. And, you know, Kamala, very smart. She's been, you know, she's been tested as in every facet. and
still didn't win. Yeah.
She couldn't pull it off either. Yeah. And
we are coming up on a break, Jordan, so I have to let you go. But so many good points made that set us up well for the next segment.
I definitely want to talk about the race issue, the gender issue on the other side. Take a comparison between the 2016 Trump win and the 2024 Trump win. Join the conversation, 888-477-9499. Studio 2, we'll be back on the other side of this break.
Am I happy? No, because I don't want to go through what we went through for 4 years under Trump with the constant arguing and bickering and division. You know, I'm really not happy with that. However, I'm going to take a Ford's word this time for whatever that word may be.
I didn't vote either way, so yeah. I don't think in the next 4 years anything will really be changed. You know, a lot of the stuff that we're all fighting with the economy, there's not so much the government can do about that because of the laws that are in place in our country.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. You just heard from Mike from Germantown and Jim from Berks County. And we are talking about the election results. Our question to you is, how are you feeling about these election results? Call 888-477-9499, and you can email studio2@whyy.org.
Quickly, let me reintroduce our guest, Terry Tracy, CEO and author at Broad and Liberty, Dan Hopkins, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, and Anthea Butler, professor in American social thought and chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania.
So we kind of talked about this before the break, but I kind of want to look at Trump's victory in 2016 and compare that to his victory this year, 2024. Both times, Trump won against a woman candidate. But it seems like his margin of victory increased, and there have been a lot of differences. And so I want to ask you, is this about race and gender, or is this how much of that contributed to his win this time versus the time in 2016? And Thea, I'll start with you on that issue of race and gender.
I think a lot of it did. I want to throw something else into the mix that we haven't talked about, we don't have time to talk about today, and the role of disinformation. Mm. Because I think this is a very important point about how people come to where they come to. On my way here, I was in the car with an Uber driver who had a lot of disinformation and talked to me about what he thought was happening in the election. But to get back to race and gender, I do think that this is an issue, and it's been a loud issue in this election cycle. And I think that while on the state levels, you know, there's pushback, except of course in Florida, about abortion, I think that gender is going to be the preeminent issue coming into the next 2 year cycle of when we go back in, you know, is it 2026, right?
Yeah.
To elect, because I think that the ramifications of what has happened with the fall of Roe and everything else will be very, it's starting to be starkly apparent now, but it will be even more apparent. That's number one. Number two, race. I think we have to talk about, and this is something that I talk about in my book, White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America. One of the things that we have to talk about is not race in this kind of flat way, but what I call the proximity to whiteness. And what does that mean? And so, in other words, for people who are immigrants, for people who are coming here, you know, whiteness is power.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to talk about this stuff at the same time when people are dismantling DEI and everything else. But somebody and people understand this, that this is how power gets to be in this country. And I think for a lot of people, including people of ethnicity, having a white president is much more comfortable for them than having a woman back to 2016, or having, you know, a mixed race woman who has, you know, mixed
interracial relationship,
yeah. You know, mixed religious background. Right. People want the comfort. What this election tells me is that when we talk about we want to go back to what it was like and we want to make America great again, then what does that mean? And what does the greatness of America mean? Because I think people have these ideas about the 1950s or whatever that, you know, that are not historically based. Let me just put it like that.
And that sparks a follow-up question in my mind to you, Dan and Terry, kind of like, did with Democrats sort of trying to smash this glass ceiling, did they in some ways create a man problem, because it seems like they have this gap where a lot of men have been very drawn to Trump. They don't feel like there's this space in the Democratic Party. So I want you to talk about the gender issues from that perspective. And Dan, start with you.
Absolutely. And I think one of the challenges of these conversations is that on the one hand, we want to be analysts, right? We want to know what fraction of this group went for this or that candidate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But on the other hand, we're at a highly polarized time. And so invariably, what seems like analysis then bleeds over into blame, into judgment, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that election analysts like myself have to be really, really careful that we acknowledge the diversity of these groups and acknowledge that there's no natural baseline, right?
Yeah.
There's no reason that we should expect African Americans to vote 90% of the time for a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
And so we shouldn't put any moral – we shouldn't start with a moral judgment that a certain group owes a certain percentage mm-hmm. of its support. I would also say that there are more African Americans than there are Canadians, and we certainly wouldn't try to describe all of Canada with any one phrase or political label. And so I think we've got to acknowledge the diversity of even within the African American community, and even as the African American community continues to lean disproportionately Democratic. And I think the final thing I would say then is that absolutely. This is the United States of America, and you're not going to have these conversations without recognizing the deep role and the embedded role of race, racial differences, and also of gender and gender differences, right? When I started in graduate school now, you know, 20-some-odd years ago, one of the first things that I saw is if you want to predict whether a voter is going to be Democratic or Republican, if you want to predict how a state's politics have evolved, knowing was it part of the former Confederacy? What is its percentage African American? Is that voter – does that voter identify as African American? Those are some of the most powerful predictors. And they're, I think, an indication that we have a long legacy of race. But I also think that we shouldn't – you know, we shouldn't assume that any one group is going to contribute any particular percentage.
Mm. Here's an email from David who says, Trump's victory is unexpected but unsurprising. One of the main reasons is that Democrats talk down to anyone who disagrees with them. Email from Carl. Trump has won two elections against women and lost to a man. People won't vote for a woman.
Yeah.
And also Jane. Jane says, heartbroken that people voted for Trump after January 6th when he did nothing to stop the violent attack on police officers. And let me use that as a springboard, Terry Tracy, because I think for a lot of people on the liberal side of the aisle, they just assumed that was a red line you could not cross.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what I learned last night is that the coalitions on both sides, the sort of 40% on both sides, are so solid, I'm just not sure anything can shake them as we all kind of fight for the 20% in the middle.
Yeah.
Is that the case here, that basically either side, their standard bearer can basically do anything and get away with it and keep that 40% intact?
Yeah, I mean – and by the way, there were a lot of conservatives that had that line of thinking too and still do. I mean, whether you're talking about former Senator Pat Toomey, former Speaker of the House Paul Ryan.
Some of the leaders of the party, but it doesn't seem like the base voters really moved much off of that.
No, and I think that's – I mean, if you were to talk to base voters in the Republican Party, they would direct a lot of their ire towards establishment or legacy media and the way the issue was handled. And their mistrust for, you know, sort of D.C. bureaucracies. And it starts to wade into a lot of other issues. But I think, you know, I think this conversation about and Dan made a lot of very good points, but about race and gender is overly reductive in the sense that did the voter that voted for President Trump over Vice President Harris yesterday then how do they get to voting then for Tim DeFore, the African American Auditor General incumbent, or Stacey Garrity, who is going to win the treasurer's race? So I think that's the problem with just looking at yesterday's results in the context of the presidential outcome.
Can I jump in there and say that's a big difference between 24 and 16 in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
In 16, Trump barely won Pennsylvania and he got less than 50% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
This time, it looks like he'll get 50 or maybe higher and Republicans down the ballot won, whereas in 16, Josh Shapiro won the AG's race and other Democrats won statewide races. It's a very different dynamic.
Republicans
this time
flipped a state Senate seat in the city of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so they're going to win all three row offices Senator Casey will probably concede in the next 24 hours. David McCormick is going to win that race based on where the outstanding vote is. President Trump, to your point, won convincingly. The Republicans are probably going to take back the state house. They expanded their majority in the state Senate. And when you look at those candidates across the board, if you look at all of those candidates on both sides, but in particular because we're talking about the Republican base here, there were African-American candidates, and there were Latino candidates, mm-hmm. and there were women candidates, and they all received votes, and they received enough votes to win a convincing victory in the Commonwealth across the board. And so I think, you know, just trying to contextualize it in terms of race or gender is dangerous and oversimplifies the complexity with which voters ultimately make their call.
Yeah. I want to bring in another caller. We have Paul from Reading, Pennsylvania. Paul, you're on Studio 2. How are you feeling about the election results?
Just terrible. Just terrible. It's a disgrace that America has now become a third world nation, and we elect criminals to the highest office in our country. Mm. And Joe Biden could have changed the dynamic by preventing some of the genocide in the Mideast, and also by concentrating on the economy a little more than he did. He got the rate down to 2.5, but he didn't do anything for the average American at the grocery store or the gas pump. But it is a sad, sad day for America. And the people that voted for Donald Trump will eventually see clearly what he really is.
Mm. Paul, can I ask you real quick if you're still on the line? Mm. Would you say you're sort of to the left, typically center, right? I mean, where do you come at this from? And, you know, do you see Donald – are you sort of uniquely appalled by Donald Trump, or are you sort of appalled by all Republican policies?
I'm appalled by Donald Trump, but the Republican Congress is just – you know, all they do is what Donald Trump tells them to do, so they're really not effective. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats they're half asleep half the time, and Bob Casey is about to pay the price for that.
Thank you, Paul.
I bring myself to vote Green Party or Libertarian, but it is a sad day for our country.
Thank you so much. That's Paul from Reading. Paul touched upon my next question. I mean, Democrats, I mean, they missed a lot of things. This time, if you were a Democrat, like, what do you think? And I'm looking at you, Terry. Like, I'm looking at you, Dan. I'm looking at you. What do you think they need to be doing right now? Like, what do you think they should be thinking about right now?
Why did they willfully open the border? That was a choice. I mean, it was just the most confounding thing to me that just because Donald Trump had enacted certain policies, we need to reverse it. And immigration, which is, you know, intrinsically.
Well, I think they would say it was the moral choice. Yeah. There was the moral choice.
The moral choice,
not the political choice,
is legal immigration managed effectively, efficiently, and equitably by the federal government. That is the moral choice, because morality applies not just to those that want to come into the nation, but also those who are already here and the impact. The government has a responsibility to manage that process in a certain way. And by just indiscriminately opening the southern border and allowing millions of people to pour across it, and the country became highly problematic for Democrats, and they were unwilling to address it. And when Vice President Harris said on multiple occasions, I don't really plan to do anything different than President Biden, I get the difficult position she was putting in by having to say, well, maybe my boss missed the ball here. But you got to own the results at some level.
And so you feel like that's the biggest flaw that they had here in this election?
Overly ideological and not results-based and solutions-oriented.
Yeah.
Well, by the same token, though, as we start to wrap up, you know, a lot of people said that their top issue, if you believe these exit polls, was the economy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Inflation came up a lot. And one thing I've been fixated on is the reality that by many economic metrics, our post-pandemic recovery is unbelievable compared to the rest of the developed world.
Mm-hmm.
It does not seem that voters felt that. I don't know if that was a messaging problem or that wasn't a messaging problem. I see you're hopping at it over there, Dan. I mean, what do you think?
I mean, if you look at the United Kingdom's election, they elected a new parliament in July, and the governing Conservatives got absolutely destroyed,
yep.
right? So the Labour Party won more than 410 of the 650 seats there. And So from that point of view, and if you look at the polls across the border in Canada, Justin Trudeau's Liberals, who've been governing for almost a decade, are massively underwater. The Conservatives are going to win the next election. And so I think inflation is a particular political problem because inflation is experienced by everybody.
Everyone, yeah. It's just different than other economic woes.
Yeah. And it also – it generates a conversation, right? It is a very, very clear metric. I can see that I am paying more every time I go to the grocery store. And I feel like my paycheck is getting
me
less.
Suggests it wasn't messaging. It was a reality that the Democrats simply could not overcome. Inflation ran rampant around the world for many reasons that we could dive into. So you don't think it was messaging. It was just those – them's the facts basically.
I do think so. I mean, I think that the Biden – the early Biden administration spending certainly contributed to an inflationary cycle. But by and large, inflation here was actually lower than it was in places like the United Kingdom.
Yep.
And I would argue that the government –
and GDP was higher.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, we are wrapping up, so I have to thank everyone. You know what? I'll say this conversation made me feel a little better. It made me put things in perspective a little bit. At the very least, I enjoyed the hour. You're giving me a look, Anthea. Anthea Butler, professor of American Social Thought.
She wants another hour.
Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for your time, Anthea.
You're welcome.
Terry Tracy, CEO and author at Broad and Liberty. Thank you for coming back on the program.
My pleasure.
And Dan Hopkins, a sterling debut, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming in, guys. I know everybody was up late last night, so we appreciate the conversation. And that wraps our show today. Thank you to our producers, Debbie Bilder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thank you to Diana Martinez, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.